Okay, Professor Ari Mermelstein on the context of the rebellion in 66 CE.
Okay, good morning. Let's get started. So the topic for my lecture this morning is why did the Jews rebel against Rome in 66 CE, Korban Bayit Sheni in its historical context. Now let me pose the question in the following terms. Josephus, who we'll have occasion to talk about more extensively as we go along.
Yeah.
I don't. Yeah. Are there still a few source sheets going around? I'm not sure what everybody's doing here. Josephus writes on a number of occasions how irrational the rebellion against Rome was. Of course, we're talking about the rebellion that begins in the year 66 CE and that culminates with the destruction of Bayit Sheni in the year 70 and Masada later in the year 73. Josephus remarks throughout his writings how irrational this action on the part of the Jews was, because he says, well, it was inevitable, of course, that the Romans would vanquish the Jews. It would result in the destruction of Bayit Sheni. Why did the Jews undertake such an irrational act? Now, we could debate whether, in fact, it was inevitable, as Josephus describes, that Bayit Sheni was going to be destroyed at the end of this. That would be a topic for some other time. But the odds were certainly against the rebels from actually beating Rome, at the very least. So the question is, why did they undertake this irrational act? Now, in order to answer this question, we're almost completely reliant on Josephus's writings, because Josephus really is our only episodic account of the events of the first century CE. Just a little bit of background on who Josephus is. Josephus is a Kohen who is born to a very distinguished family in Yerushalayim in the year 37 CE. He describes himself, celebrates himself, as 1/8 descended from the Hashmonaim. He also describes himself as especially learned. He is one of the core members at the beginning of the revolt against Rome. He is he's first appointed as the general in the Galilee. He leads a disastrous campaign against the Romans. His army is wiped out within 6 months. He's taken captive by Rome. He ultimately describes an incident that is reminiscent of the story that Chazal tell about Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. He approaches Vespasian, who at that point was general, and predicts that Vespasian is about to be appointed as king. As emperor, when that happens, he is taken out of prison. He ultimately serves as the translator for the Romans at the siege of Yerushalayim. Following the Khurban, he's taken back to Rome. He's given citizenship, and in a certain way, he becomes a propagandist on behalf of the Flavian dynasty. That is, the dynasty that begins with Vespasian. So Josephus is really our first and practically only account for the events that we're going to be describing, which he talks about in two separate works. He talks about these events in his work, The Jewish War, which he writes in the year 79 CE, and that's his most extensive treatment. His less detailed, but not really less important for our purposes, account is in his other major work. He writes four separate works, but his other major work, The Antiquities of the Jews. He doesn't actually narrate any part of the revolt in Antiquities, but he goes up until that point, which for our purposes is really going to be the focus. So we're going to be looking at different passages from both Jewish War and Antiquities. Antiquities was written in 93 or 94 CE, both in Greek, both while Josephus is in Rome after the Korban. Okay, so let's just give a little bit of background, just some dates to get us oriented to what we're talking about. Josephus's account in Jewish War begins with the persecution of the Jews during the time of Antiochus, Antiochus IV in 167 BCE. We know that the Hashmonaim take over the leadership of the Jews beginning in 152 BCE. That's when Yonatan first emerges as the Kohen Gadol. The Hasmonean dynasty lasts up until lasts uninterrupted up until the year 63 BCE, which is when, in some ways, our story really gets going, when the general Pompey leads a campaign and takes over Israel. The Hashmonaim are allowed to remain in power up until Herod's reign, which begins in the year 37 BCE. All of these dates, by the way, are on the source sheet, so you can just follow along. Herod assumes the throne in 37 BCE, and he rules up until his death in 4 BCE. Following his death in 4 BCE, his kingdom is divided into three sections. For our purposes, the most important of these three is, of course, Judea, which is ruled by one of his three, he has more than three sons, but at that point, the three different pieces of his domain are ruled by three different sons. Judea is administered by his son Archelaus. Josephus describes Archelaus as having been even more cruel than Herod himself, such that in 6 CE, so he rules for 10 years, in 6 CE, the Jews send an embassy to Rome demanding that Rome depose Archelaus, and they say to Rome that they would rather be ruled directly by the Romans than continue to be ruled by the Herodian house. So that essentially Rome rules in Judea through the vehicle of the existing Jewish leadership for 70 years, from about 63 BCE up until 4 CE, up until 6 CE, at which point the Romans now take over direct rule of Judea. For the next 60 years, essentially, and there's a slight hiatus at one point, which we'll talk about, but we have the rule of a set of Roman administrators known first before the year 41 CE as prefects, after the year 44 known as procurators, and that lasts up until the very beginning of the revolt in the year 6 CE. What happens in 6 CE is that Archelaus is deposed. The Romans now issue a charge to the Kohen Gadol at that point, who had been installed, as we'll talk about, by Herod himself, to undertake a census of the Jews, which was going to be necessary, of course, for taxation purposes. Josephus describes that action of trying to take a census as having sparked an outcry, at least among part of the small sector of the population, led by a person named Judas the Galilean. Judas the Galilean, according to Josephus, cries out that the Jews cannot be ruled by the Romans, the Jews can only be ruled by God. Josephus calls this perspective the fourth philosophy, says in addition to the first three philosophies, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes, the other three major sects that he talks about, he says there's this fourth group represented by Judas the Galilean, which he's unable to kind of follow. There's no thread that we can really connect from that moment up until the revolt, with some exception. But he wants to at least suggest that that was somehow a seminal moment, so the very beginning of direct Roman rule, when Judas the Galilean declares his opposition. The prefects rule up until the year 41. Josephus gives us some accounts, primarily accounts that occur under Pontius Pilate, some cases in which Pontius Pilate showed clear religious insensitivity to the Jews. Agrippa I, that's Agrippas HaMelech in rabbinic literature, is appointed as king, so now we have the hiatus that I referred to, in the year 41 CE. Agrippas is the grandson of Herod and the great-grandson of the last of the Kohanim Gedolim of the Hasmonean dynasty. So that is, Herod married the daughter of the last Kohen Gadol of the Hasmoneans. So his father-in-law was a Hasmonean Kohen Gadol. Agrippas is the grandson of that woman, Mariam, and so grandson of Herod, great-grandson of the last Kohen Gadol, and so he's revered by the people as basically perpetuating not so much the Herodian line, but more the Hasmonean line. He dies in 44 CE, at which point Rome again administers direct rule because Agrippa's oldest child, Agrippa II, is deemed too young to actually take control. And at this point, the Roman administrators, known as procurators, take over. Now, this is when Josephus's narrative gets especially detailed. And he tells a story about the period running from 44 CE, following Agrippa's death, until 66 CE, that we can basically describe as consisting of two separate points. First of all, that Judean society was a flashpoint, constant flashpoint of strife, almost a pressure cooker that was ready to explode. That's kind of point number one. Remarkable upheaval. Point number two, that because of that remarkable upheaval, revolt was inevitable. The war became really an inevitability. Now, so how does he, what is this narrative which I'm describing, what does that look like? What's occurring during this period? So now if you go back to the source sheet, I have now detailed, the bullet points really give some of the most remarkable remarkable episodes of this period. He has very little to say about the first two procurators from 44 to 48. His narrative really gets going with the procurator in 48 named Cumanus. Cumanus, Josephus says, Josephus talks about two major episodes as having taken place during his 4-year procuratorship. First of all, he describes a Roman soldier who at Pesach exposed himself outside the Beit HaMikdash, causing a riot among the Jews. He says that the masses now rose up against the Roman soldiers who were on site, and somehow a stampede ensued. 30,000 Jews were killed. A second major event, which we're going to come back to at several later points, is, and here we have, there's a discrepancy between the version that Josephus describes in Jewish War and the version that he tells in Antiquities. A group of Samaritans kill either one Galilean or a group of Galileans who are going south to be Ole LaRegel, and in response, those assembled in Yerushalayim, hundreds of thousands, go north to avenge the death of either this one Galilean or this group of Galileans. Cumanus the procurator leads his soldiers north to kill and disperse the attacking Jews. Eventually, the matter gets brought before the emperor. The Jews complain that Cumanus had acted inappropriately. The Samaritans claim that the Jews had acted inappropriately. Cumanus, as we'll describe, ends up sending some of the leaders of the Jews to Rome in fetters, and also sends two separate embassies, Jewish and Samaritan, to argue their case in front of the emperor. That's basically Cumanus. Claudius. Okay, Felix is the next procurator, year 52 to 60. It's important to kind of just go through the series of events just to give us a sense of what's happening. Felix is the procurator in 52 through 60, and Josephus here really makes 4 points about his procuratorship. He says, first of all, there was widespread brigandage, and this is now something that he says was almost an epidemic for the last 15 years of Vayecheni. He says that the perpetrators, and here's the quote, they were interested in looting the houses of the wealthy, murdering their owners, and setting the villages on fire. So the impression of these brigands is not that they were revolutionaries in some way, but that they were basically interested in causing anarchy. They were basically paid mercenaries who Josephus describes as really causing chaos. There's a subgroup of these people known as the Sicarii, who, again, Josephus wants to suggest had some kind of revolutionary intention, but the narratives that are told about them suggest that just like these other brigands, they were basically just concerned with causing chaos and enriching themselves.
These are Jews.
The major story that we're told about them under Felix is that they were bribed by Felix to kill the Kohen Gadol, who we'll talk about later, Jonathan, the son of Ananias. And after that, the Sicarii become so powerful that they essentially mingle with the crowds at the Chagim, and they are able to murder individuals, causing total chaos. They carry these small daggers, and that's kind of their mode of operation. The two additional things that happen under Felix, and again, the Sicarii are a group that continue. They're the group that end up at Masada toward the beginning of the war. There also, according to Josephus, is a rise of false prophets. Now, what's interesting about this claim by Josephus is he only actually gives us an example of one such false prophet, even though he wants to say this again was an epidemic. He describes an Egyptian who led 30,000 people up to Har HaZeitim. he said he was going to enter Yerushalayim, overpower the Roman garrisons, and set himself up as king. Felix takes soldiers and, accompanied, he says, by the masses of the Jews, again decimates those 30,000 people, wipes out the Egyptian and his people. And the fourth thing that begins, and again, this is now something that we can trace up until the beginning of the revolt, is Gentile-Jewish violence at Caesarea. Caesarea, at this point, is a mixed city of both Jews and Gentiles. The Jews claim that they are entitled, they're the leaders of the city, because Caesarea had been founded by Herod. The Greeks in that city say, no, they're the rightful citizens, because when Herod built Caesarea, he set up all kinds of pagan stuff there, and so really, they were the ones who were the rightful citizens. Armed conflict breaks out, and again, what happens here is Felix sends some of the Jewish leaders to Rome in bonds, and both sides are allowed to plead their case to Nero in Rome. Okay, Felix is now leaves in the year 60. He's replaced by a procurator named Festus. Josephus tells us very little about him, other than the fact that brigandage, he says, became the principal plague of the country. We then come to the last two... Yeah?
What do you define brigandage?
So it seems like it's really social banditry. In some cases, it looks like Robin Hood, kind of stealing from the rich and giving to the poor. In other cases, it's really just these robbers who are just interested in looting. So it seems to be two kind of different sets of groups. Yeah? Okay, so that's the critical question that we're going to have to come back to.
30,000 in a riot.
Yeah, so the critical question is going to be, how reliable is Josephus? That's what we're going to have to come back to.
Another critical question. Nowhere so far do we have any information that anything that Rome did was wrong.
Okay.
Rome was this benevolent, just trying to keep the peace. No cruelty of Claudius was known to be terribly... apparently, Nero was crazy. I mean, there's none of this.
So
everything is blamed on the Jews. So who had this so-called brigandage? I think
that's So the one thing that I omitted here, which I probably should have put down, is that there is the episode involving Caligula, where Gaius Caligula wanted to install an image of himself in the Beit HaMikdash, and that caused, you know, an outcry both in Egypt and in Judea. That was really, in some ways, for Josephus, the first instance in which the Romans really overstepped their boundaries. There were a number of incidents already during the reign of Pontius Pilate, from 26 to 37, in which he brought in the standards into Yerushalayim, which had the image of the emperor on them. He took from the temple treasury in order to build an aqueduct. So there were certain things that they did that were, Josephus describes as having been insensitive to Jewish religious sensibilities. But really, the biggest problems, according to Josephus, occurred during the last two procurators we're going to talk about now, Albinus and Florus. And here he reserves really remarkably harsh rhetoric condemning both Albinus and Florus. About Albinus, and we'll read a passage later in which that describes Albinus's reign. He says Albinus took bribes and was only interested in enriching himself. And not only does he condemn Albinus for the way in which he administered Roman rule, but he also says that at this point we find Jews fighting against Jews. We'll see later that the chief perpetrators of the conflict between Jews were really the leaders. It seems like the Kohanim and the descendants of Herod were involved in what I describe here as internecine strife. Albinus is removed in 64, but the same condemnation that Josephus reserved for Albinus, he now follows up about Florus. Florus, we can now begin to trace a sequence of events which, at least according to Josephus, again, leads inevitably to the revolt in the year 66. And the sequence of events goes as follows. He says, at the beginning of Florus's reign in 64 or 65, the conflict that I described earlier in Caesarea between the Jews and the Gentiles continues. There are a couple of events that happen there that... again, spark an armed conflict between the Jews and the Gentiles. Florus, to the surprise of the Jews, sides with the Gentiles, despite the fact that he accepted a bribe from the Jews. What he then does is, right, so everything that he does, essentially, Josephus describes as having overstepped his bounds. He then goes and takes 17 talents of gold from the temple treasury. Again, that sparks an outcry among the Jews, and as we'll see, Josephus says that 3 million Jews go up to the governor in the area. So we're talking about, these are the procurators, kind of local administrators. There's a governor over the entire area who's based in Syria. When he comes down, Cestius Gallus, who we'll talk about later, comes down to Yerushalayim, 3 million Jews, and again, the numbers are almost certainly inflated, but the point is that there is this outcry on the part of all of the Jews when Florus does this. The next day, according to Josephus, a number of Jews, he calls them hot-headed youths, went and mocked Florus by pretending to be poor people collecting money on Florus's behalf, because otherwise why would Florus need to go and take money from the temple treasury? Florus is offended by what happened, and he requires that the leaders of the Jews in Yerushalayim hand over the people who had mocked him. Surprisingly, they don't. And we'll come back to that point. The question is, why didn't they simply hand over these people? Because this is going to pose, this really in some ways is the breaking point, when the Jews refused to hand over the ones who had mocked Florus. Florus then unleashes his soldiers on Yerushalayim, and again, thousands, Josephus describes thousands of people as having been killed. The Jews force Florus to flee. What happens at that point is Agrippa II, who I had referred to before, who was appointed as king over areas in the north, but his direct domain is not really in Yerushalayim. He's present in Yerushalayim at that time, and he gives a very long speech, an eloquent speech in which he pleads with the Jews to maintain their allegiance to Rome. And this is where the kind of the Josephan voice is very apparent. He says, he goes through a list of people that had succumbed to Roman domination. He says, if you're going to now rebel against Rome from what they've done against you, just know that it's an act of you're deluding yourselves, and there's no way that you're going to be able to overcome Rome. The inevitable result is that Baiacheni is going to be destroyed. He is shouted down, is forced to leave Yerushalayim. What happens next is that a number of the Kohanim, and we're going to talk more about the events during the time of Florus a little bit later, but a number of Kohanim, led by somebody named Elazar ben Ananias, who Josephus calls the captain of the temple, the Skan HaKohanim, so he's essentially almost the second in command, stops bringing the traditional sacrifice that had been offered on behalf of the Romans, which had been offered traditionally in the Beit HaMikdash. That kind of symbolic action means that now they are independent of Rome, such that they don't need to turn to God and ask God to protect Rome. That really seems, according to Josephus, to kind of have been a breaking point. The leaders in Yerushalayim plead with those Kohanim to restore that traditional sacrifice. They say it violates Jewish law, which traditionally requires you to offer these sacrifices on behalf of the foreign empire. Again, these people are shouted down. The Roman garrison that was based in Yerushalayim is then butchered by this kind of the emerging revolutionary group of people who had stopped bringing the sacrifices on behalf of the Romans. At the same time, fighting is breaking out between Jews and Gentiles elsewhere, both in Israel and outside of Israel, and it's clear that trouble is brewing. And so now, the procurator really is out of the picture. He's really, Florus is basically incapable of restoring order. And so the more powerful governor in the area, who's based in Syria, named Cestius Gallus, comes south with a massive army at his disposal. According to Josephus, he, had he played his cards right, should have entered Yerushalayim, and would have ended the war. Not that he was going to destroy the Beit HaMikdash, but he would have been able to overcome the rebels, and that would have been that. But what happens is he inexplicably, and again, we can't know why he did this. Josephus says that it was completely irrational. He inexplicably, he's at the walls of Yerushalayim, he's almost able to enter into the Beit HaMikdash, and for some reason he turns around. turns back to Syria, and that exposes a weakness in his line. The Jews are able to pull up from the rear, destroy his entire army, force Cestius Gallus to flee, and now essentially the Jews are, you know, declare their independence. Right? This is basically the greatest victory that the Jews are able to win at the very outset of the war. So now, independent of Rome, they now appoint a war council. The war council, we'll see, is led by one of the former Kohanim Gzolim named Ananus ben Ananus, Hanan ben Hanan, who leads the revolt for the first couple of years. The generals are appointed over the different parts of Israel, with Josephus leading the charge in the north, and that's really as far as we're going to get today. So that's basically a long recounting of events that lead up to the year 66. Now, all of this, everything, yeah. Yeah, so it seems to have been a korban that was brought traditionally on behalf of the foreign empire for centuries. We know that when Antiochus's father, Antiochus of the story of Hanukkah, when his father enters Jerusalem in the year 198, so Antiochus IV takes over in 175, when his father, Antiochus III, enters Jerusalem in 198, one of the things that he stipulates is that the Jews, he's going to supply the Jews with funds to offer sacrifices on behalf of the Seleucid dynasty. This is not a new innovation.
This is something that matters to the Romans. If you do
it, yeah, I mean, it seems. Yeah, I mean, it seems like it was. Yeah, it seems. What's that?
That it seems to be the parallel story to the Gemara Gittin.
Yeah, right. Right, yes, correct.
I mean, in other words, how we superimpose one on the other becomes,
correct,
you know, the
right
other question.
Right.
But Chazal certainly are reflecting,
right,
knowledge of the same,
right,
the same,
correct,
tradition and its importance in the
entire story. Yeah. Right, correct. Yeah.
Yeah, but there's a difference between stopping and causing a womb and that will happen.
And causing a what?
Causing a womb. I mean that's
yeah, right, but the principle that this that somehow this was a seminal moment. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, from a contextual point of view, all of this timeline also overlaps the life and death of Jesus and the rise of brother Christian.
Yeah, so
is this just like a little sideshow that has no impact here?
Story
this,
of Jesus?
Yeah, and the rise of Christianity. Is this?
Yeah, so Josephus, yeah, so Josephus has a couple of passages in which he mentions the Jesus movement, this early Christian community. One of them is probably the most famous passage in all of Josephus, talks about Jesus. There are questions about whether any of it is original to Josephus, whether some of it is original. It clearly has been tampered with by later Christians. And he says about Jesus that Jesus was a wise man who was beloved by the Jews. He says about him, you know, if we may call him a man. So that part is clearly, he says he was the Messiah. This is Josephus, who describes himself elsewhere, maybe as having been himself, as having been a Pharisee. So he's not a follower of Jesus. He says he was a Messiah. He says that he was killed by our chief rulers during the time of Pontius Pilate.
Our meaning Romans.
No, our, the Jews, the chief priests. And he says that on the third day he rose and appeared himself miraculously to his.
That was all shown to be false, and later additions. What you're saying now was shown to be not.
No, so it's debated. Well, it's debated. Some copies of Josephus later don't have this passage, which is why some people suggest that the entire thing is not original. I think that there are good reasons for thinking that the core of it is original to Josephus, but that it's clearly been tampered with by later people. That would be, we could talk about that after. But that and then he says that he rose on the third day. That's clearly not original. And he says that up until this very day, the tribe of Christians continues. So, and that he in a story that we'll see later, in the year 59 or 60, it's 62, between two procurators, Ananus ben Ananus, the person who I said was led the war at the beginning, took the opportunity to convene the Sanhedrin and hold trial and execute James, the brother of Jesus. And that actually led to Ananias' being deposed as Kohen Gadol. So those are really the only things that Josephus tells us about the early Christian community. There's a separate tradition that describes that community as fleeing to Jordan as all of this is taking place. So, but that's as far as what we can say about what's happening on the Christian side. That's really, I mean, of course, Acts of the Apostles, which is the story of Paul's life, again, that, you know, describes, well, when we talk later about a certain person named Ananias, he's involved in the trial of Paul. So there's certainly, if we wanted to look at Acts, there would be a lot more stuff that we could say about what's happening there. And it's an important, and the Gospels and Acts of the Apostles are important sources also for everything that we're describing now. Yeah.
Who was Josephus' audience?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So he says that he wrote the Jewish War that he wrote an Aramaic version of the Jewish War before he wrote the Greek version. So we don't have that Aramaic version, but if that is in fact the case, so he clearly was addressing the Jews of his time. He says that Titus read the Jewish War and basically signed off on it. He endorsed it. What I'll say in a few minutes is maybe we'll come back to that in a few minutes. But I think that the short answer is that he's largely addressing the Romans, I think, secondarily the Jews, but I think that we have good reason for thinking that he's speaking to a primarily Roman audience. Yeah.
From what I'm hearing so far, you say that he considered himself a Pharisee, and that it seems to be blaming this group
First of all, not all of the Kohanim were Sadducean. Some of the important ones we'll see were Sadducean. Ananias ben Ananias, for instance.
But that would be consistent with his
but he actually reveres some of these people. So Ananias ben Ananias, who was at Stuki, he has very good things to say about him. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, so that is the first, Rabban Gamliel's father, was one of the core members of the Revolutionary Party at the beginning of the war. So clearly there were Pharisees who were sitting alongside of Sadducees in this war council. So, you know, the idea that there was any sectarian split is probably not correct at this time. But we are going to talk about the role that the leadership played in all of this in a few minutes. Okay, so now the problem, if we want to talk about what were the causes of the war, is how exactly to go beyond Josephus. Josephus basically says everything that happened during the time of Florus, the taking of the money from the temple, the cessation of the sacrifices, the civil strife that broke out in Caesarea, the massacring of the Roman garrison in Jerusalem, all of that led directly to the war that broke out in 66. He says that there are also some longer-term incidents that led to that, or longer-term, I guess, trends, one of which began with the fourth philosophy, which I said before, Judas the Galilean, was real deeply rooted anti-Roman sentiment. Another thing that he says is this, you know, messianism, what I described before as the rise of the false prophets. He says that there were class tensions with a socioeconomic divide at play. That's the brigands that I said before were looting the wealthy, killing the wealthy. That seems to be, according to Josephus, also to have contributed to all of this. The incompetence of the procurators, especially the last two, Albinus and Florus, and the struggle between the Jews and Gentiles in primarily Caesarea. Now, the problem is we could simply accept Josephus's analysis of the revolt and say the revolt happened because of everything that I just described. But for a number of reasons, that's a very problematic stance to take. And it's problematic for a few reasons. It's problematic because Josephus is not a disinterested party in all of this. He's a very partisan point of view. First of all, and really in some ways this we should think of this as his primary purpose, is to acquit himself of any wrongdoing. In fact, one of his four works, called Life of Josephus, is explicitly written in order to defend himself against certain accusations that were leveled against him about the 6 months during which he was general in the north. He's very concerned with making sure that his reputation is upheld. And so part of, you know, part of his agenda in general is to make sure that he comes out looking very good
to the Jews.
But he also, and to the Romans, but he's also interested in two other things. He's interested, first of all, in propagandizing on behalf of the Flavian dynasty, showing how kind they were. Titus really didn't want to destroy the Beit HaMikdash. He describes this conversation in which Titus and his war council, Titus says, I really don't want to destroy the Beit HaMikdash. It would be sacrilegious, and it only happens because of an accident. So he propagandizes on behalf of the Flavian dynasty, but he also, and this in some ways is his most important point, he wants to suggest that the war was only led by a small group of Jewish rabble-rousers who basically overwhelmed the masses of the Jews and led them into war. But that the overwhelming majority of Jews were completely allied with Rome, didn't want to go along with that revolutionary party, but the revolutionary party somehow swept them up and led them into revolt. That really, in some ways, is Josephus's major point. And David, going back to your question before about who is his audience, so in that regard, it seems like Josephus is speaking to the Romans and saying, look, don't think that you can't now trust the Jews, because in fact, the people who rebelled against you were only a very small sector of society. You've either wiped them out or taken them into slavery. But you should continue trusting the Jews. You can continue trusting them as leaders in Israel. That seems to be a major focal point of his work, especially Jewish war in general. Now, that goal really drives a lot of the way that he tells the story of the first century CE. Because what I said before is that the way that he talks about the first century CE, first of all, is that he says that it was basically a flashpoint of strife throughout that period, pressure cooker that was boiling over, number one, and number two, that the war was inevitable. So what that does for Josephus is it basically acquits the masses of any wrongdoing, because they were basically just the victims of Jewish-Roman, the fighting between the Jews and the Romans, specifically between the procurators and the Jews, fighting amongst the Jews, which we'll talk more about a little bit later, which was mostly taking place at the level of the leadership, and fighting between the Jews and the Gentiles. But that the masses really were basically caught up in this maelstrom of events that had nothing to do with them, and that led inevitably to the revolt. That's the way that he talks about the first century, because that is the point that he wants to make. So if we want to take him at his word, it's problematic, because he's clearly representing a partisan point of view. That's, yeah.
I'm curious, Rome conquered many lands. Are there any parallel authors, so to speak, like Josephus in another land?
Yeah, about people writing about revolts, is that what you mean?
Or defending their own, so to speak, to Rome.
Not that I know of. Moshe, can you think of anybody? Not that I know of. Nobody who comes to mind. Okay.
So
yeah.
You would then ask, so why would Josephus be working so hard on behalf of the Jews?
Ah, interesting. So why? It's not so much why is Josephus working so hard, but why? Why has Josephus' work been preserved? I mean, we can't know. We can't know what else is out there. So that really is that I guess is. I mean, we can still ask why is Josephus working so hard, but I'm not sure that we can necessarily explain why his is the only work if we don't know what else.
I want to speak to that here. He said there was a revolt of Jews in many cities throughout the Roman Empire. According to certain historians, there is. The Jewish population of Roman Empire was huge. And so that they had significance to the entire Roman Empire, this revolt in Rome, whereas a revolt in Armenia might not have had any implications.
Okay. Are there what?
Are there other accounts, other historical accounts
of revolts? Of the Jews. So Josephus's life of Josephus is responding to another account that was written by a person named Justus of Tiberias, whose work doesn't survive, but Josephus says he's responding directly to his account, which condemns the way in which Josephus conducted the war. So there certainly were other accounts, but they didn't survive. Tacitus talks a little bit about some of the events, but very, you know, and most of what he says is consistent with what we find in Josephus.
Was he writing from first-hand experience, or was he based on
I think he was. I don't think he was at the siege himself. Yeah. Okay. Now it's further problematic for a couple of other reasons. Not only is his point of view a partisan one, but it's not clear how exactly these different factors come together. Josephus wants to say, well, this factor about messianism led to the brigandage, and that led to the fighting between the Jews and the Gentiles, as if one led inevitably to the next, which led inevitably to the war. But it's not really clear that they're in any way connected, and it's not even clear that most of these factors had anything to do with the Romans at all. So what I said before, in terms of there having been some kind of class warfare with these brigands fighting against the especially wealthy Jews, that doesn't seem to have anything to do with the Romans, especially if these people are basically just mercenaries interested in causing anarchy. The messianism that I talked about, messianism was rampant in that period, but most of it had nothing to do with the Romans. Most of it didn't actually take any kind of political form. So it's not surprising that Josephus can say, well, there are all these false prophets, but then only give one relevant narrative, because it's not clear that there were many people like that running around. So it's not clear that much of this had anything to do with the Romans in any case. Even if we wanted to say that some of this had something to do with the Romans, it's not clear, and maybe this in some ways is the most important point, it's not clear that the revolutionaries themselves were either messianists or were members of the lower class. To the contrary, we'll talk about them in a few minutes as having been members of the upper class. They're not members of the lower class. There's no reason to think that they were involved directly in the events in Caesarea. The question isn't what was happening in Judea, but what led the revolutionaries themselves to revolt. And we have no reason for thinking that any of this had anything to do with the revolutionaries themselves. Those are really, I think, the major problems with Josephus's account in general, in terms of explaining what led to the revolt. The problem, if we want to give some type of alternative account, is that we can't really go beyond Josephus. For the reasons that I stated before, everything that we know about this period basically comes from Josephus. And so if we want to take his facts and interpret them differently, it's problematic, because all that we have are his facts, and in some way, the facts that he presents are shaped by his interpretation of the events. He wants to say, well, there is widespread chaos that was limited to a certain group of people that led inevitably to the revolt. That shapes his facts. And so it's very hard to go beyond Josephus if we want to say anything more. Question then is there some way in which we can supplement his account? Can we find data that will allow us to give a slightly different perspective on the revolt itself? So that is to find something that's not in Josephus that will help us better understand how the revolt actually took place. And here, one, I think, productive line of inquiry that some historians have taken is to look outside of Jewish society at that time and look to the way that the Romans administered the Roman provinces in general. So what do we know? What can we say about the interactions between other people living in other provinces under Rome and the Romans that would help us understand how the Jews were different? Meaning, our question shouldn't be, why did the Jews rebel against Rome, but why did the members of this Roman province rebel against Rome? What was different about the Jews in this province that led them to fight a battle against Rome? That would allow us a different kind of data set, because what we would start with is not only Josephus, but looking at the Judea within the context of the wider Roman Empire in general. And that data set goes as follows. What we know about the way that the Romans administered the provinces in general is that they typically delegated rule to the local elite, to the local population, to the local elite, who were typically the most important criterion was that these people were wealthy. The wealthy on the ground usually had the support of the local population, so it was natural for the Romans to charge them with the responsibility, first of all, of maintaining order and of serving as the liaisons between the local population and the Romans. So that when the Romans took over direct rule, when Archelaus is deposed in 6 CE, they're going to look at the people who are, they regard as the local elite. Who are the local elite? For the Romans, those are always going to be the wealthiest class of people, because from their perspective, those are the people who are going to enjoy local prestige. The problem in the case of the Jews and Judea is that the wealthy were not the same as the people who enjoyed the prestige among the people. Because traditionally, enjoying prestige among the Jews in Judea involved two things, one of two things. Either lineage, and here we're talking about lineage as it pertains to the Kahuna, or as it pertains to the Hashmonaim, is number one. And number two is scholarship. Those were the two sources of prestige among the Jews. But the people who were wealthy in 6 CE, when the Romans now took over control, really could claim neither of those sources of prestige. They couldn't rely on lineage, and they couldn't rely on scholarship. Now, why is that? It's because, here we have to go back to the way that Herod began his reign. Herod removed from power two different groups of people. He removed from power anybody who was associated with the Hashmonaim. He, as I said before, he marries the daughter of the last Kohen Gadol and actually installs as his first Kohen Gadol his wife's sister, so that is the son of the previous Kohen Gadol, but basically has him... whatever, right, you understand. Whatever it was that I said was wrong. But he very quickly has this Kohen Gadol murdered. This was typical of Herod. He basically killed off anybody who was associated with the Hashmonaim, including his wife. This wife, who I said before, he also disposes of her within 10 years of their marriage. He ends up killing, toward the end of his reign, he kills their two sons. Herod had two sons from her, one of them the father of Agrippa, kills them at the end of their reign. He eliminates everybody associated with the Hashmonaim, and he installs as the Kohanim Gdolim, because of course the Hashmonaim are the high priests at this time, he installs as the Kohanim Gdolim people who were totally obscure from non-traditional families of the Kohanim, most of whom didn't even come from Israel. For the most part, they were from either Alexandria or Babylonia. During his 33-year reign, there are no fewer than 7 Kohanim Dolim, so it basically becomes a puppet institution with Herod completely deciding who actually gets to occupy that role. And so, because these people were not from the traditional line of the Kohanim Gdolim, and because Herod was so despised, the people who came to occupy that role were not those who would enjoy the prestige, would kind of have authority or enjoy prestige among the masses. Now, because this became such a revolving door, we're not only talking about one Kohen Gadol, but what ends up happening is we have full families of Kohanim Gdolim. Josephus, we'll see, talks about the elite among the people in the first century as high priests, because the families of former Kohanim Gdolim continue to vie for power. And so these are no longer individuals. We're not only talking about who is the current office holder, but who are the former office holders and who are their families. And Rome just continues this practice. I mean, Rome when they take over in 6 CE, again, continue the practice of deposing and then appointing people who are from these non-traditional families. And as such, the people who occupy positions of authority, who Herod had given property to, had invested with great wealth, are not those who are going to be able to say, well, look who I am. They are Kohanim, but they're not going to enjoy any sort of authority simply because they're Kohanim, because there are lots of Kohanim running around. And the fact that they are the Kohanim Dalim isn't going to do very much for them because they're Herodian or they're Roman Kohanim Dalim. So that's one set of people who are among the wealthy, who the Romans are now going to turn to in 6 CE and endow with this authority to maintain order on the ground. That's one set of people. Yeah?
With Kohanim or Kohanim Gedolim among the revolutionaries?
Yeah, that's what we're going to talk about.
But then,
yeah.
How did they get? Where did they get the prestige from?
So we're going to that's what we're going to have to talk about. That's exactly where we're. That's basically everything else that we're going to talk about. Okay, so that is there like an official time limit that I have? Okay, people should be willing to leave, but it's, yeah, okay. We're going to go a little bit over an hour, I think. Is that okay? Yeah, okay. Okay, so, but people should be complete. I guess it's going to be taped and posted somewhere, so if you need to leave, please, I'm not remotely offended. I teach and my students come in 30 minutes late, 40 minutes late. They leave 30 minutes early. It's nothing. Everybody sat for 50 minutes. I'm proud of everybody. So, okay. So now there is another set of the local elite who are extremely wealthy. We know about this other class of wealthy just archaeologically. We find these magnificent houses in Yerushalayim that were clearly occupied by people of tremendous means. We can't know exactly where these people came from. They're not all Kohanim. So it's been speculated that these people would have had money somehow. Maybe they were benefiting from when people were coming being Olah L'Regel, they must have spent money in Yerushalayim, so maybe these people acquired wealth that way. Then they lent money to, let's say, farmers who, in return for that loan, offered up their property, and when they couldn't repay that loan, these people would now confiscate their property and now become extremely wealthy landowners. The support for that would be, as we'll see later, apparently there were this massive storehouse of debt records, which will get burned, as we'll see, on the eve of the revolt, which suggests somehow that debt was a major problem at that time. The fact that it's burned by some of the revolutionaries, who themselves weren't, the revolutionaries that we'll talk about were actually from among the elite, so they're not burning the debt records, as we'll talk about, because they were the ones who were in debt. They were the contrary. So, but apparently this was a source of dissent and of dissatisfaction, and it could be that these other super rich people were acquired their wealth in this way, somehow managing to lend out money to those in need and then confiscating their property when they were unable to pay them back. So, not that they were
consistent with what I've heard of what Jesus said when he overturned the money lenders.
Yeah. So the money changing tables is a separate problem in and of itself. They weren't corrupt, but we'll see that we'll talk about it. We'll talk about what they were doing, which was not commendable, as we'll see. But yeah.
Are you going to talk about the power from scholarship, because you sort of didn't go back to that? And I'm just wondering
power from scholarship. With Herod. Is that what you're going to say? Of Herod.
For scholarship being a form of elite at that point.
In 6 CE?
In 6 CE.
I mean, only the evidence would be, first of all, you have Matthew says that the Pharisees occupied the seat of Moses, which is obviously that's problematic, but it does reflect, at the very least, it reflects something.
I think that's a reading of a rabbinic construct back into 6 CD, and I really wondered whether it would be true.
Okay.
It could be, but and that evidence from Matthew and
right.
You don't really have.
Well, the Pharisees. Right. Well,
lineage, we have
well,
a really clear
right. What you do have is you have Alexander Yanai telling his wife. Make sure that you placate the back in 76. Make sure you placate the Pharisees because they're the ones who are the most powerful. And so she shifts sides from the Sadducees to the Pharisees.
Pharisees equals scholarship itself is a jump.
Right. Maybe.
The evidence for those two.
Okay. Maybe.
And scholarship are really very, very.
Okay. Possibly.
Quality.
Okay. Possibly.
The
possibly.
Other thing is the physical presence of the Sanhedrin.
Yeah, so the problem with the Sanhedrin, as we'll see, is that it's not, at this point, it's not a rabbinic institution. It's clearly a mix, and this we know both from the New Testament and from Josephus, it's an institution that is comprised both of Pharisees and Sadducees, and as we'll see, Hanan ben Hanan, who is this, as I said, is going to be the one who leads the war council at the beginning, is himself a Sadducee, and who himself convenes the Sanhedrin in order to try James, the brother of Jesus. So, so the Sanhedrin is itself a separate issue, but it's clearly at this time a coalition that consists both of Pharisees and Sadducees. We could talk about it. I'm not totally sure, but
the Romans didn't have anyone.
Yeah, that's it. Right. That's the right. Exactly. That's whether or not. And even and the point is that whether they could rely on people who were Kohanim or scholars, that wasn't unique to these people. And so that wasn't going to be something that the wealthy could hang their hats on. Which means, if they were going to be charged, these wealthy people, with having to maintain order, collect tribute, and serve as the people's representatives to Rome, they were going to be completely reliant on the favor of the procurators in order to do so, because they couldn't rely on the people to support them in that capacity. If they wanted to maintain their power, they had to make sure that they remained in the good graces of the procurator himself. That would become a major problem, as we'll see, as we get closer to the revolt, when, because there seemed to have been upheaval in Jewish society, again, we can, there, again, with some of the details, I think we could reasonably call into question, but there does seem to have been upheaval in Jewish society, certainly toward the end of Bayit Sheni. These people were going to be unlikely to successfully maintain and restore order on the ground when that upheaval occurred, which we'll look at some sources in a few minutes that will kind of support that contention. But that's going to be the major problem. The major problem is going to be that the leaders of the people don't enjoy any sort of prestige on the ground, meaning they can't actually execute their responsibility that has been imposed upon them by the Romans. So when it comes time, when they will fall out of favor with the procurators, as they do later, their only recourse is actually to turn against the Romans. That's essentially the narrative that we're going to play out as we go along, and I will fill in all of those gaps in a few minutes, but that essentially is kind of is where we're headed. Yeah, David.
Just quick, those Herodian and Roman high priests,
yeah, those are the people in the first century. Yeah, these are all of the people who are condemned. The revolving door of Kohanim that Chazal talk about is the revolving door that we know to have been, to have actually taken place, as Josephus describes. Okay, so let's now take a look at some sources from Josephus. We find several places in Josephus in which groups that he refers to as the principals among the Jews were unsuccessful in suppressing the masses from some type of anarchic behavior, right? Meaning they were unsuccessful in actually maintaining and restoring order. Now, where do we see this? So, take a look at page 2. There are a couple of sources that are relevant to this question. One of them is the narrative that I described before, a story that takes place during the procuratorship of Cumanus, during the years 48 to 52. You have the Samaritans killing a number of Galileans. The Jews in the south, in Yerushalayim, now go north to avenge the deaths of those Galileans. Look at the portions that are underlined at the in that top passage from Antiquities, book 20. And when their principal men, and now we're talking about the principal men among the Galileans, that's how Josephus always refers to these leaders, these wealthy leaders, who's, and this is important, Josephus is one of these people. That's something that we need to keep in mind as we kind of go on. When their principal men endeavored to pacify them and promised to endeavor to persuade Cumanus to avenge those that were killed, they would not hearken to them. So they refused to listen at the beginning to the request of these elite to stop. Subsequently, they do manage, after many of the Samaritans have been killed, their leaders do impress upon them the need to now retreat, stop the killing. That's what we have in the next set of underlines, that next underlined passage, whereupon those that were the most eminent persons at Jerusalem, and that both in regards to the respect that was paid them and the families they were of, and again, this is Josephus, a member of this class, so everything that he says about them needs to be taken with a grain of salt. But these people, as soon as they saw to what a height things were gone, put on sackcloth and heaped ashes upon their heads, and by all possible means besought the seditious and persuaded them that they would set before their eyes the utter subversion of their country, conflagration of their temple, etc. And these persuasions of theirs prevailed upon them. So at the very end, meaning after the slaughter has now taken place, finally the people do listen to the most eminent persons of Yerushalayim. But look at what the procurator Cumanus does at the end. Look at the end of the passage, the last few underlined lines in the next paragraph. But he still sent away Ananias the high priest and Jonathan ben Ananus, the commander of the temple, in bonds to Rome to give an account of what they had done to Claudius Caesar. Okay, this, we're going to come back to both of these people. Ananias the high priest, who we know to have been the Kohen Gadol from 47 until either 49 or 59, and Jonathan ben Ananus, who was at one point the Kohen Gadol and apparently now is the Skana Kohanim, they represent two of the most powerful priestly families at that time. Jonathan ben Ananus is one of five brothers who are Kohanim Dolim in the first century. This Ananias, remember I said before that the person who stopped bringing the sacrifices on behalf of the Romans is Eleazar ben Ananias. That's his son. So we're talking about two people that are going to play, and Jonathan ben Ananias, his brother, Ananias ben Ananias, is the one who's going to lead the revolt in 66. So these are two parties that are going to play, two families are going to play intimate roles, clearly leaders among the people, and they're being sent away by Cumanus in bonds because of what's happened in Rome. I mean, what is the problem with what has happened? What did I say? What did I say? They're sent in bonds to Rome. Yeah, whatever. Yeah, right. Okay, I didn't have coffee this morning. So, right. Whatever. So, in response to what happened in the Galilee. Oh, yeah, that's what I... Right. In response to what had happened in the Galilee, because the point is that Cumanus blames the ruling... these elite for not actually maintaining order on the ground. He blames them precisely because they were not able to execute their charge from the Romans themselves. So this is at least early on a failure of the leaders that is recognized by the Romans, who understand that they have not now somehow executed their responsibility to do what they were supposed to do. And again, these are the Kohanim Gedolim that I described earlier. One additional, the other thing that we see from here, of course, is that they're not able to, they don't enjoy sufficient prestige among the people, and if they then fall out of favor with the procurator, they're done. Right? That's the other important detail that we see from here. Okay. Again, similar kind of thing that we see in the next paragraph, which describes a dispute that took place during the procuratorship of Felix from the years 52 to 60. Okay, Felix is... This is now describing what happens with in Caesarea. Remember, I described the clashes that took place in the year 59 between the Jews and the Gentiles there. When Felix saw that this quarrel was become a kind of war, he came upon them on the sudden and desired the Jews to desist. And when they refused to do so, he armed his soldiers and sent them out upon them and slew many of them and took more of them alive and permitted his soldiers to plunder some of the houses of the citizens which were full of riches.
Well, now, is this the war between the Jews and the non-Jews, or the war between the Jews and the Romans?
Jews and non-Jews in 59.
So they were trying to keep order.
Correct. Now, those Jews that were more moderate and of principal dignity among them, again, these are the purported leaders among the people, these wealthy, who Josephus is always going to describe as more moderate, were afraid of themselves and desired of Felix that he would sound a retreat to his soldiers and spare them for the future and afford them room for repentance for what they had done. And Felix was prevailed upon to do so. So what Josephus describes here is their inability, the inability of these people of principal dignity to actually maintain order on the ground. All that they can do is plead with the Romans to retreat. Now, Felix does so, but again, it's a failure on behalf of these rulers to actually maintain order on the ground. These are kind of two incidents that illustrate the ways in which they were unable to suppress the masses from any kind of anarchic behavior. So since they were unable to acquire power through the masses, what I said before is that they had to win power through the procurator. And that too we see in a number of places, the ways in which they tried to curry favor with the procurator. Let's take a look at two cases. The first case is, now we're on page 3, that top passage. Remember I said before that two of the people that were taken captive to Rome after the incident between the Galileans and the Samaritans, two people that were taken were Ananias, and who was the Kohen Gadol, and Jonathan ben Ananias. Thank you. What we have described here is that same Jonathan ben Ananias, who apparently had been in Rome and had engineered the appointment of Felix to come as procurator in the year 52. Felix, Josephus writes, also bore an ill will to Jonathan the high priest, because he frequently gave him admonitions about governing the Jewish affairs better than he did. Meaning, Jonathan is telling Felix, this is how you have to govern the Jews, lest he should himself have complaints made of him by the multitude, since he it was who had desired Caesar to send him as procurator of Judea. Meaning, he played the pivotal role in having Felix appointed in the first place. So Felix contrived a method whereby he might get rid of him. Now he was become so continually troublesome to him, for such continual admonitions are grievous to those who are disposed to act unjustly. Wherefore Felix persuaded one of Jonathan's most faithful friends, a citizen of Jerusalem, whose name was Doris, to bring the robbers upon Jonathan in order to kill him. And this he did by promising to give him a great deal of money for so doing. And that's what ended up happening. So we see a couple of things from here. We see, first of all, that Jonathan recognizes that if he wants to have real power among the Jews in Judea at this time, his only route for doing so is to operate through the procurator. And so he, you know, very strategically, while in Rome, having been taken captive, manages to engineer the appointment of this Felix. Again, what the other thing that we see from here is that when Jonathan falls out of favor with the procurator, he's done, because that's his only vehicle for power, for authority. Okay. Now, because they couldn't rely on the masses for authority, what we end up finding beginning in the 50s and into the 60s CE is a real factionalization of this elite, especially the Kohanim Gdolim, where we have different parties among them, rival groups vying for power with each other. We see this in the next passage, and in some way this next passage is the most pivotal for our purposes. It's describing the events that occurred during the time of Albinus, okay, who ruled again from 62 to 64. Actually, turn to page 4, because we have these parallel descriptions. Turn to the top of page 4. This is Josephus in Jewish War, describing what happens during the time of Albinus. And he says, without naming names, now to the audacity of the The audacity of the revolutionary party in Jerusalem was stimulated. The influential men among their number secured from Albinus by means of bribes immunity for all their seditious practices. Again, we're talking about the influential men. While of the populace, all who were dissatisfied with peace joined hands with the governor's accomplices. Each ruffian, with his own band of followers grouped around him, towered above his company like a brigand chief or tyrant. Talking about Jews now. Employing his bodyguard to plunder peaceable citizens. The result was that the victims of robbery kept their grievances, of which they had every reason to complain to themselves, while those who escaped injury cringed to wretches deserving of punishment through fear of suffering the same fate. In short, none could now speak his mind with tyrants on every side, and from this date were sown in the city the seeds of its impending fall. It doesn't name names. What's interesting is that if we go to the same account in Antiquities, we see who these tyrants actually were. So now go back to page 3. That bottom passage basically describes the same set of events. Now, as soon as Albinus was come to the city of Jerusalem, he used all his endeavors and care that the country might be kept in peace, and this by destroying many of the Sicarii. But as for the high priest Ananias, again, this is the person, the Kohen Gadol, who we said was sent to Rome at that earlier point, he was sent to Rome along with Jonathan ben Ananus, right? We have the names down?
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so Ananias, he increased in glory every day, and this to a great degree, and had obtained the favor and esteem of the citizens in a signal manner, for he was a great hoarder up of money. He therefore cultivated the friendship of Albinus and of the high priest Jesus. At this point, this is just after Ananus ben Ananus has been deposed in 62 for having killed James, the brother of Jesus. Jesus, son of Damnaeus, is appointed Kohen Gadol. That's the person that we're talking about now. Ananias is, by means of money, cultivating the friendships both of the procurator Albinus and of the current office holder, Jesus, son of Damnaeus, by making them presents. Now, what does this have to do with gaining the favor and esteem of the citizens? So he's gaining the favor and esteem of the procurators, but apparently in doing so, the citizens come to now have greater respect for him because they recognize that if he has the ear of the procurators, he can therefore serve as an effective voice for them, an effective liaison to the Romans themselves. But he doesn't simply stop with bribing both the procurator and the Kohen Gadol. He also had servants who were very wicked, who joined themselves to the boldest sort of the people and went to the thrashing floors and took away the tithes that belonged to the priests by violence and did not refrain from beating such as would not give those tithes to them. So the other high priests acted in the like manner, as did those his servants, without anyone being able to prohibit them, so that some of the priests, that of old, were wont to be supported with those tithes, died for want of food. Again, who are the tyrants who are, according to the way that Josephus describes earlier, who are setting themselves up like brigand chiefs, employing bodyguards to plunder peaceable citizens? That's Ananias and his group, these extremely wealthy people. But now the Sicarii went into the city by night, just before the festival, which was now at hand, and took the scribe belonging to the governor of the temple, whose name was Eleazar. This is Eleazar ben Ananias, who we're going to see shortly, is the one who stops bringing the sacrifices on behalf of Rome. So Ananias' son binds him and carries him away with them. After which they sent to Ananias. Ananias is forced to now redeem his son who had been taken captive. This is now part of a larger kind of factional warfare. We don't know why the Sicarii did this, whether they did this at the behest of somebody else. But again, this is now a picture of chaos that the elite are not now suppressing, but are actually participating and actually promoting. And now Jesus, the son of Gamliel, became the successor of Jesus, the son of Damnaeus. Now we're at this is Yoshua ben Gamla, in the high priesthood, which the king had taken from the other. On which account a sedition arose between the high priests with regard to one another. For they got together bodies of the boldest sort of the people, and frequently came from reproaches to throwing of stones at each other. So now it's not simply that one faction among the Kohanim Gedolim is now taking by force stuff from the other Kohanim Gedolim, but now they're actually throwing stones at each other. That is, who are the people we're talking about? The faction associated with Yoshua ben Gamla and the faction associated with this Jesus, the son of Damnaeus, who are in conflict because for some reason Albinus had deposed Jesus, son of Damnaeus, in favor of Yehoshua ben Gamla. So now they...
Is this what the Marx made for Sezakim?
When it, yeah. But Ananias was too hard for the rest by his riches, which enabled him to gain those that were most ready to receive. Remember, we just said that Ananias was allied with whom? With that Jesus, son of Damnaeus. Meaning when Jesus, son of Damnaeus, took over as Kohen Gadol, and it's a lot of names, which are all sound similar, so it's a little hard to... But Jesus, son of Damnaeus, who was Kohen Gadol in the year 62, Ananias forges ties with him by presenting him with presents or bribes. When that Jesus, son of Damnaeus, is deposed and Yehoshua ben Gamla takes his place, Ananias apparently maintains his allegiance to the former office holder and supports him in his, sounds like, almost armed conflict with the new office holder, Yehoshua ben Gamla. But it's not simply the Kohanim Gadolim who are being involved here. We then find out that it's also some of the people who had been associated with the Herodian court. Costabaris also and Saulus did themselves get together a multitude of wicked wretches, and this because they were of the royal family. We know that these were people who had been associated with Herod, and so they obtained favor among them because of their kindred to Agrippa. They're associated with Agrippa, who was himself associated with Herod, but still they used violence with the people and were very ready to plunder those that were weaker with them, that were weaker than themselves. And from that time it principally came to pass that our city was greatly disordered and that all things grew worse and worse among us. So it's not simply the wealthy Kohanim Gadolim that are now vying for power with each other. It's also this Herodian group, these non-Kohanim, there's no reason to think these people are Kohanim, who are now participating in this, in the factional violence. All of this because if they wanted to maintain their grip on power, the only way that they could do that would be violently. There was no other way that they could, violently or through gaining the favor of the procurators, but there was no natural way for them to actually attain any sort of authority.
Their violence wasn't directed against Rome.
Right, correct. Right. So far, this has nothing to do with Rome. The problem is what will happen when the procurator loses all faith in the Jews. In the elite. Because until now, it's been possible for the elite to maintain their grip on power as long as they are able to placate the procurator. But what happens when the procurator is no longer able to trust them? Now, the more that they participated in and promoted the violence, the more that they were no longer part of the solution, part of the problem itself. And so we shouldn't be surprised that, now we're talking about the events that we just read about are in the year 62, that as we progress toward the revolt, it's not surprising that the procurator loses faith in these elite to actually serve their role as people who are going to maintain their grip on power. So what happens when we get to Florus in 65 and 66 is precisely that. The procurator is no longer trusts these elite to serve their role, forcing the elite, if they want to maintain their power, now to side with the Jews who want to fight against the Romans, rather than serving to maintain order, they join forces with those who are actually seeking chaos, seeking anarchy, seeking almost rebellion. Okay, let's see how that happens. Here's the narrative of events that happens under Florus, and I described some of this earlier. All of the seminal events under Florus involved these local elite, the high priests, which again are not simply the current office holders, but they're the families of all current, past, and aspiring office holders. All that elite plays a role in everything that happens under Florus. First thing that Florus does is he refuses to intervene, as we said, on behalf of the Jews in their conflict with the Gentiles in Caesarea. Here you have on page 4. Sorry, what happens before that is Josephus condemns Florus. Look at that second source, Jewish War, Book 2, line 280. And truly, while Cestius Gallus was president of the province of Syria, nobody did so much as send an embassy to him against Florus. But when he, that is Cestius Gallus, came to Jerusalem upon the approach of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the people came about him not fewer in number than 3 millions, who besought him to commiserate the calamities of their nation. Again, the numbers are almost certainly exaggerated, but the point is that there is a mass response to what Florus is doing. So there's widespread dissatisfaction among the people. When Florus then does not side with the Jews in their conflict with the Gentiles in Caesarea, he agrees to take a bribe from the Jews, but then, to the surprise of those same Jews, he sides with the Gentiles and not the Jews. Meaning he's already setting up some kind of a division between him and those who are actually supposed to be siding with him. So there's already a gap that is emerging. That gap widens with what happens next, which is, as I said before, he goes and takes the gold from the Beit HaMikdash. Some unnamed, who Josephus described as hot-headed youths, go and mock him by taking the collection on his behalf. When he goes and asks the Kohanim Gedolim in Yerushalayim, again, the people that he describes as the principal citizens, chief priests, and most notable Pharisees, those people, Florus goes to them and requests that they hand over the people who had mocked him. They refused to do so. And that becomes kind of the breaking point between the procurator and these elite. At that point, Florus sees that the local elite are incapable or unwilling to serve their role, and that really is the end of the road for these local elite. Now, again, what I said before is it was almost an irrational move on their part to not hand these people over. Why wouldn't they want to at least try to play their role if they want to now maintain their position of power? So it's been speculated that it's because the people who were mocking Florus in the first place were precisely members of their own group, and so they were going to be really unwilling to hand over kind of some of their contemporaries, some of their colleagues, and that's the only way of explaining why they would have taken what was otherwise a really irrational act. The next thing that happens is that Florus now sends his soldiers to sack Yerushalayim, and Josephus says a remarkable thing. He says that what was most offensive about what Florus did is that for the first time, Florus crucified Jews who were Roman citizens. And this, for Josephus, is unprecedented and remarkable. Who are these Roman citizens? Of course, we're talking about these same people. Meaning Florus is blaming the people who refused to hand over these people who were mocking him, and he ends up apparently crucifying tens, if not hundreds, of them. The next thing that happens, this is what Josephus says, is the first time that anything
this
like...
Is 70, right?
No, this is 66. Oh, 65,
this
yeah.
This is way after the supposed Jesus time.
The who?
Jesus wasn't a Roman citizen.
No, no.
But the important thing here is he's crucified Roman citizens.
What makes the Jews Roman citizens?
Yeah, okay. Well, maybe we'll talk about that afterwards.
Okay.
Yeah. The very next thing that happens is the Jews stop bringing sacrifices on behalf of the Romans. Now, as I said before, who is it who stops bringing these sacrifices? It's the son of the Ananias who we've been talking about the whole time. The Ananias who was described by Josephus as being extremely wealthy, as having bribed the previous Kohen Gadol and Albinus in order to maintain his grip on power, who had been, even before that, sent to Rome to answer for his inability to suppress the masses. His son Eleazar is the one who stops bringing sacrifices on behalf of Rome. So we have the local elite who now have been pushed to the side by the Romans, by the procurator, whose only route to power is now going to be to side with the masses against Rome, because the masses apparently have come to despise Florus. 3 million of them just prior went to Cestius Gallus to complain about Florus. And so now the only route to power for these people is no longer to try to side with the procurators, but to try to become the voice of the people. And so what is it that Eleazar ben Ananias does next? He doesn't simply stop bringing the sacrifice on behalf of the Romans. He does two additional things. He burns the debt records, as I said before. Why does he burn the debt records? He's the son of the person who Josephus said is fabulously wealthy. So he doesn't have any debts himself. It's because he's trying to speak on behalf of everybody else, meaning the people who are not members of his group, and trying to say, look, I am your vehicle. I am now on your side against the Romans. That's one thing that he does. The second thing that he does is he arranges for his father's house to be vandalized. Again, his father, who had been this person who had terrorized, set himself up according to Josephus as a tyrant, who terrorized the masses, he now goes and vandalizes his father's house, again, as a display of whose side he's on. Now, this doesn't mean that everybody now, all of the members of the elite now, rally around Eleazar. To the contrary, the factionalism that had been in place throughout this period now continues, and Eleazar, according to Josephus, is opposed by everybody else. So there's a long speech in which, again, as I said before, the group that he refers to as the principal citizens, chief priests, and most notable Pharisees all come out and elaborate on how Eleazar ben Ananias had violated Jewish law by doing this. They urge the people to restore the sacrifices, but the people refuse to listen. So, the opposition then send two separate embassies. One to Florus, and one to Agrippa II. And we have like another 3 minutes, so we're almost done. Who are members of the embassies that go to Florus and Agrippa, urging them to now come and suppress what is now kind of a revolt bubbling over? The two members of these embassies were, on the one hand, Saul and Costabar. Anybody remember who Saul and Costabar were? The Herodians, right, who were described previously as having been among these tyrants in 62. So there's some members of the elite who are now, if Eleazar is now opposing the Romans and they're not going to side, they're now out of power. So they need, if they don't want to side with Eleazar, they need to now turn very quickly back to the procurator, maybe because they don't trust, they want to make sure they're on the winning side. And so they now go on an embassy to the procurator. Eleazar's brother, Simon, the son of Ananias, so Eleazar is now the one opposed to Rome, his father is the really rich one. The other brother, Simon, son of Ananias, is the other member of this embassy who goes to Florus and Agrippa, urging them to come and again suppress what is now happening. So you have what is clearly, we can clearly trace who the people here are. They're all members of this elite. The question is, whose side are the elite going to be on now that Florus has now, now that a kind of unbridgeable gap has been put in place between the procurator and the Jews. What the kind of the final stage in all of this is that the revolt takes place. The pro-peace party led by Ananias is wiped out by Eleazar. Ananias himself is killed. The war council is convened. Ananus ben Ananus is appointed as the leader of the revolt for the first 2 years of the revolt, from 66 to 68. Ananus ben Ananus, as I said, is one of the prominent people in this class of people, one of five Kohanim Gedolim from his family. It's not a surprise that the masses appoint him, and apparently there was a popular assembly that sent him up. It's not surprising that he's the one who was chosen, because remember, he was earlier deposed by the procurator after he tried and killed James, the brother of Jesus. And so somebody who had shown himself to be, at least ostensibly, an opponent of the procurator, at this point is going to be the one who is going to be hailed as their leader. Okay. All of which is to say, to go back to Josephus, it's much more complicated than Josephus wants us to think. It wasn't inevitable that the revolt was going to break out. The revolt didn't simply break out because of all of the causes that Josephus pinpoints. It broke out because the very people who were supposed to maintain order on the ground were never in a position to actually be able to do so. They weren't in a position because of their origins with Herod. The Romans hadn't helped matters by basically just continuing the practice of Herod, basically making the Kahuna Gedola into kind of a revolving door. A power struggle among them ensues. An inevitable gap develops between them and the procurator, and that really is what leads to the revolt. Without the resources and capabilities of these people to kind of motivate, or at least to channel a lot of the opposition on behalf of the masses who are now opposed to Florus, without these elite on their side, the revolt may never have happened. Now, it's not a surprise that Josephus doesn't tell us any of this, because, of course, Josephus is interested in protecting the member of his own group, trying to pin the blame on a revolutionary group who he says were from among the poor, were lower class. He and members of his group were among the moderates, which may have been true. It may be that many members of his group were among the moderates, but that was precisely because they may have felt like their route back to power was not by siding with the revolutionaries, but was by siding with the Romans. But what we see is that it's really not the case that these people, Josephus wants to describe as rabble-rousers, were actually from the lower class. These are people, contemporaries of his, where the factionalization of this group is simply continuing, and it's all about how is this group going to maintain their grip on power. We wanted to kind of just to think about how, you know, what this can kind of can contribute. Of course, the reason I gave this lecture now is because of it's right, everybody understands in Yana Dugyoma, right? So it should be right. So just to think about what, you know, any of this has to kind of contribute to our own reflections on Tisha B'Av. So certainly at the very least, it tells us something about the role that leadership has to play in the life of the Jewish community. I'm not going to, we're an hour and a half in, so I'm certainly not going to say anything more than that, but certainly the lessons that can be learned in terms of the role that effective leadership can play in the destiny of the Jewish people, the flourishing of the Jewish people, and how much we allow our leaders to play that proper role, and how much our leaders are willing to accept that mandate, certainly is I think something that's worthy of reflection on the basis of these kind of reflections of what happens leading up to the revolt. Okay, thank you very much. I'm around if anybody has questions.
The delegation sent to Rome to ask Rome to intervene, or to what?
They were sent by Rome to intervene. Yeah.